Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is a foreign policy for the middle class. With me to discuss the relationship between foreign policy and the success of the American middle class is Roslyn Engel. Roz is a distinguished professor of the practice in economics at the U.S. Naval Academy and a non-resident scholar in the Geoeconomics and Strategy Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She is also the founder and president of the World Affairs Council of New Jersey. From 2016 to 2018, Roz served as a senior career executive at the Treasury Department in charge of U.S. macroeconomic analysis. From 2013 to 2016, she was a National Intelligence Manager and National Intelligence Officer for Economics in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Roz has also held several teaching and research positions within the Department of Defense. Roz, thanks for joining me.
I'm really glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, Roz, the idea of a foreign policy for middle class has gotten a lot of attention in recent months with the Biden administration. And a lot of people trace it back to a report that you co-edited that was published last year by the Carnegie Endowment on making U.S. foreign policy work better for the middle class. So perhaps you can start with the big picture, which is, what do you mean when you say a foreign policy for the middle class?
Sure. So I think I might give a little bit of background to the report, the task force, the method, the motivation, because I think it's actually kind of helpful in understanding kind of how and where we landed.
Go for it.
So the report came out of the work of a bipartisan task force that worked over a little more than 2 years out of the Carnegie Endowment. I would say that the election of 2016 was something of a trigger that created a lot of soul searching in Washington among a lot of foreign policy experts and practitioners with the kind of, you know, America First agenda that emerged out of the Trump administration, which really represented, you know, kind of a sharp repudiation of the kind of foreign policy status quo and really led to a lot of discussions in Washington and beyond about what where trade policy, international economic policy maybe not served the broader interests of the American public or had become delinked from broader interests within the American middle classes. So that was kind of what spurred a whole set of activities, really. So it started in around 2017, and I should give lots of credit to the people who got the project going. That was Salman Ahmed, who's now Director of Policy Planning at the State Department, Jake Sullivan, now a National Security Advisor, obviously, and then Bill Burns, who was leading Carnegie at the time and felt strongly about the project. So there were a lot of people involved from the beginning who felt strongly that we needed to re-examine. And the method was also a little different. So the group decided that instead of doing the kind of traditional foreign policy study where you would look at your external actors, you look at the threat environment, you kind of assess national interests, and then you kind of proceed from there. This took a much more kind of inside out kind of approach, did 3 state level in-depth studies, Ohio, Colorado, and Nebraska, went out and talked to people, a wide swath of people from these states, partnered with local universities, talked to economic developers, middle class focus groups, businesses, lots of different people, and kind of did these kind of really deep dives. And then from that, knit together a lot of the things that we had heard in those 3 state studies, and then tried to think about what did those perspectives really bring to the conversation. And I'll just end this little section with a kind of a quote from one of the first reports. And it was, the aim is not to sell Ohio on any particular set of policies devised in Washington. Rather, it is to sell Washington on the need to better understand the aspirations of middle-class families and communities in Ohio.
Well, let me ask you, Roz, on that point, why you took this approach? Because the report says quite explicitly that many Americans, including many Americans you spoke to for the report, don't have a really good understanding of foreign policy or which particular issues affect them or their prosperity. So why go to people and ask them what they think about foreign policy if you have reason to believe and they admit they don't know how all these things fit together?
I think because there is a sense, well, first of all, governments rely on and follow ultimately the preferences of voters. So when we saw in the election of 2016, if your populace feels very disconnected from the foreign policy aims and goals that the foreign policy community is trying to articulate and trying to advance, but those are not well understood, that you can create, you know, a lot of instability in your foreign policy establishment. So you can go from a globally engaged administration like the Obama administration to an America First agenda. And that can happen with one election. So I think there was a sense that we needed to understand not what, you know, the American middle class thought we should do on specific policy issues, but how they defined their own interests and how they saw their larger economic interests affected by, to the extent that they could make those connections, things that were going on in Washington. And then, you know, the task force, I think, felt strongly that it was our responsibility in some sense to try to draw those linkages a little bit more clearly, to articulate them a little bit better. But, you know, fundamentally, American power, American interests really have to sit on this foundation, right, of a healthy, vibrant, dynamic middle class. And if they did not see the benefits of globalization, and I should say, actually, many of them did, some reactions to the report have been along the lines of it feels kind of protectionist. It feels a little kind of pulling back from a more ambitious foreign policy and maybe questioning kind of global engagement. But that's not really broadly what we heard. What we heard was people generally support and understand that the U.S. needs to remain engaged globally. They would just like to see the foreign policy and policy establishment generally manage the downside risks, some of the transitions, and some of the challenges a little bit better.
So I just want to make sure I'm following you here. Your assessment was that foreign policy played a significant role in the outcome of the 2016 election. Now, I know that's a story that's often told in Washington. I'm a political scientist by training. I think most of the political science research argues that while elections are consequential for foreign policy, 2016 being a case in point, it's not really the case that foreign policy matters much for how people vote. Indeed, a lot of the political science literature over the last couple of years has suggested that foreign policy and trade policy in particular didn't play the kind of role that is often talked about here in Washington. But you have a different view, or?
No, I think what I would say is that, you know, I'm an economist by training, so we'll probably talk past each other a bit, but I'll try not to do that.
It's all right. It's okay to be an economist. I don't know about being a political scientist, but it's okay to be an economist.
So I would say that the 2016 election was a bit of a trigger for some rethinking. I think there was a fairly significant recognition that it wasn't foreign policy that drove the election, but it was, you know, a broad set of economic interests, economic trends to do with long-term trends in economic inequality. Some of those things are related to globalization, but a lot of it is not. It's technical change. There's some tax and transfer policies. There's kind of declining economic or labor mobility and market concentration. There's a lot of things going on that are contributing to that trend. So I do think that these bigger structural economic concerns were very important in the election, but they did get kind of tied into a general anxiety around trade, where trade became kind of a proxy for, you know, questions about, you know, what was globalization? Was globalization adding to these pressures? Was globalization and U.S. global leadership too costly for the American middle class? What was the American middle class? How would they benefit from this? It was just not well, a lot of those benefits were not well understood. They were not well articulated. And there were a lot of economic anxieties and frustrations that have been building for years. So I think it was more opportunistic in a sense, right, in the election of 2016 to choose these trade issues, which really resonated in particular parts of the country that are very important politically, and then use them to kind of shift, you know, foreign policy in a very different direction ultimately. And I think that was where the task force, I would say, made the connection between the election, foreign policy and economic interests. Maybe that clarifies things.
Well, let me draw you out a little bit on this point, Roz. I thought the report, which, by the way, people can get by going online to carnegieendowment.org, did a very good job of laying out the problem. You know, we talk about public policy analysis. There's generally three phases. First is, you know, problem definition or problem recognition. Then there's diagnosis, which is why did the problem come about? And then there is the recommendation phase. What do you do about the problem? You know, your prescription. In terms of sort of problem definition, what is the problem? It seems to me the report really sort of lays out many of the ills affecting the American middle class. I don't think any of those surprise people. They've been sort of talked about an awful lot. I think the question comes in when we get to the issue of what is the relationship between those problems and foreign policy? So maybe you can sort of lay out for us what I take to be the diagnosis that foreign policy choices that successive administrations, Democrat and Republican, made intensified the problem of the American middle class.
Yeah, so I would say that the report itself is, I think it's best viewed as sort of a lens, as a reframing of how to think through kind of what the strategic, you know, organizing principles or strategic framework should be for thinking about kind of foreign policy priorities. And I wouldn't say I would read it as a highly evolved, detailed policy agenda, though I think we can get into that, like kind of where I think it looks like it's going and some of the stuff that the task force talked through. So I think, you know, in the course of doing some of the work on the report, I ended up reading, I don't know, like 3 decades of national security strategies. And one of the things you see in the national security strategies over time is this move from a very strong kind of Cold War mentality, which very much used economics as a way to build military and security power. So economics was just a base upon which to project power. And there was also sort of a strong sense of defining the U.S. interests in terms of free markets, expanding market access, ultimately in the kind of 80s, 90s. Is where it kind of goes, the interests of American companies abroad. Kind of then we're sort of segue into things like general interests in the kind of prosperity and using trade and economic openness as a pathway to prosperity. And it's only until the very late strategies that you see any real recognition of the distributional consequences conversation in the United States about jobs, stagnating incomes, these links that people are beginning to make publicly between, you know, the difficult kind of hollowing out of the middle class in the United States and some of the pressures that they're facing in a global economy. So I say that by way of saying, you know, the document or the report was really kind of trying to move the conversation into one where we were, as a foreign policy community, trying to grapple a little bit more directly with some of the distributional issues. How does foreign policy advance things like an inclusive growth agenda? How does foreign policy advance good job creation? How does it solve the problems that the American middle class perceives to be in their interests? How do we do defense and security policy in ways that help to stabilize, protect, buffer American middle class households from shocks abroad, from terrorist attacks, from all kinds of different threats that might be out there? So I think it's as much a reframing as it is a, you know, really detailed policy agenda. It also sort of makes the link and the argument that we've tended to see domestic and foreign policy as very separate silos. You mentioned in my bio, right, I spent a bunch of years in national security and then 3 years as the national intelligence officer. As the NIO, I think I had like 180 economies, you know, that I was supposed to follow, right?
So a lot of countries.
There were a lot of countries. Everyone except us. Like my job was everyone except us. And then when I went to Treasury, I had just us and no one else. And the dichotomy there was really interesting. And I was at a fairly senior level of both places, but I did not have conversations across that aisle, right? I really wasn't in either place, you know, in terms of leading U.S. macro analysis, having conversations with our foreign policy folks who were kind of like talking to us about some of the risks that we might, the U.S. might be facing, nor were we briefing them back on things that were going. That happens at the very senior levels, right? At the National Security Council and the NEC, but it's not really happening at the next levels down where it probably should be happening more. And I also think, for example, the fact that the Biden administration is leading with a lot of, I mean, partly because of COVID and the economic situation that they're inheriting, right? But are leading with a lot of big economic renewal ideas at home. And I think the idea there is that those are, in a sense, creating a stronger foundation for the U.S. foreign policy community to advance U.S. interests abroad. If people feel more secure at home, if they feel that they have a little more mobility, a little more opportunity, a few more buffers, that perhaps the U.S. foreign policy agenda will be able to be a little more agile in coming years. So I think that they do see these, you know, this need to integrate foreign and domestic policy as pretty important.
So let's talk about this at a meta level, which is the ills of the American middle class are real and well documented. But to what extent does foreign policy, however you wish to define it, whether it's narrowly foreign economic policy or more broadly to include everything that we do overseas, responsible for those ills. And I will note that the report itself goes on at some length to talk about a variety of domestic factors that are as important as, or perhaps more important than, foreign policy in the decline of the middle class. And I think it's important to sort of have a discussion about how important you think foreign policy is, because if it's these domestic factors, whether it's tax policy or it is education policy or it's things like the ability of people to move from state to state and satisfy licensing requirements, if domestic politics is more important, why shouldn't we be talking about domestic politics rather than talk about foreign policy?
You know, I think I agree. I mean, the report does make clear in a number of places that probably the bulk of the work that needs to be done to bolster the American middle class and improve kind of the dynamism and vitality of the American middle class will fall into the domestic sphere. So I think that's said in numerous places throughout the report, that this is not, you know, fall squarely into the foreign policy lane. But there are places where foreign policy and these other policies intersect, and foreign policy could perhaps amplify the effects or they could dampen the effects. So a couple places where foreign policy mattered and we heard about it mattering in Ohio, Colorado, and Nebraska. So Ohio, trade was a fairly big conversation because of the decline in manufacturing. So there was interest in trying to understand how to improve the competitiveness of Ohio, the Ohio workforce, the Ohio communities, and not just to find that domestic job down the street, but be able for Ohio companies to compete globally. So there's something like 96% of the world's consumers are actually outside the United States. And so there's a recognition by businesses in all the states we talk to that there are opportunities for them. You know, not every industry, but many of them see themselves as having possible opportunities. So there's, you know, there's that, which is wanting to make your community as competitive as possible, knowing that the world has been globalizing and there are opportunities out there. There's foreign direct investment, which is another big area in Ohio, Colorado, and Nebraska. There's significant amounts of foreign direct investment. And those tend to create relatively good jobs. So there's lots of Japanese investment in Ohio, for example, and some of that's helped to stabilize even some of the auto industry. So I think FDI and how we go about creating a good climate for foreign direct investment, that is something that the foreign policy community is involved in. Immigration is another area. It's not maybe considered like classic foreign policy, but the American public definitely views it in the realm of you know, a foreign policy or a policy that's affecting them. So in Nebraska, it's a very, in a funny way, very pro-immigration state. They have workforce shortages across the state. They're very interested in trying to bring seasonal workers in, but also long-term full-time workers. They have a pretty big refugee and resettled populations in parts of Nebraska. So immigration policy and getting immigration policy right was another one. Getting services trade right. So for Colorado, for example, they do a lot of trade in energy services and business services. So services trade and how that evolves will matter for various parts of the country. So I do think, you know, people understood that, yes, you know, a lot of what is ailing the American middle class is going to take some domestic policy interventions. But if they are lashed up well with foreign economic policies that really help to stimulate growth in states and give people a sense that they can compete globally, then I think those were things people were really interested in.
I guess my question, Roz, is a bit more macro. It's more a matter of, you know, is foreign policy 50% of the solution? Is it 25% of the solution? 10%? Because, I mean, the reason I ask is, again, if you think that this is fundamentally a problem of foreign policy, then yes, you should spend a lot of time talking about it in terms of foreign policy. But if it's primarily a problem whose roots are in domestic policy, particularly domestic policy, that is not doing enough to make sure that the distribution of benefits from the American economy are widely distributed, or because we don't have a safety net built up across the country, it's harder to see why we're talking so much about a small part of the problem as opposed to the big part of the problem.
Honestly, I don't know if I could put a percentage on it. So I guess my question back a little bit, maybe I'm going to push back a little, is what percentage of the foreign policy work that gets done in Washington should incorporate concerns about middle class economic well-being? Right. So another way to think about it is, instead of saying, well, how much should the foreign policy community be doing to address some of the longstanding issues facing the American middle class. Let's say somebody says, well, that should be 10%. Well, what's the rest of the 90% that the foreign policy communities should be doing? So if you know they shouldn't be doing any of this, then what are they doing? And I think if you think about it that way, I would say the task force was trying to make a case for the middle class economic interests, right, playing a more prominent role in foreign policy conversations generally. Whether foreign policy is going to solve every ill that faces the American middle class? No. Does foreign policy have all the tools it needs to do any of that? No. But should foreign policy be more informed by and motivated by understanding how to advance middle class interests generally? Yes. So I think, you know, if I switched it a little bit and I asked, you know, how much should the foreign policy community care about this? I'd say they should care a lot about, right, advancing the broad interests, you know, of the American middle class and doing it across a whole set of tools that they do have.
No doubt that's true, Roz, but I think the rejoinder I often hear is that it's difficult in much of foreign policy to know what it is that works for the middle class. I mean, what is a Russia policy that works for the middle class, or a non-proliferation policy that works for the middle class, or what is a North Korea, South China Sea, Taiwan policy that works for the middle class? And in fact, a lot of what foreign policy about is not simply about economics, but it's about security and providing an environment in which the United States is secure. And so that's, I think, hard on many of these issues to know exactly what the interests of the middle class are separate from the rest of the country.
Yeah, and I think that's very fair. So I've gotten a lot of questions like that. You know, what does foreign policy for the middle class mean for, you know, US-UK relations? What does it mean for Indo-Pacific? What does it mean for great power competition? You know, and I don't have the answers to those questions, right? Yeah. I would only say that I think it's interesting and useful for some of these communities to ask the question. Not sure there is a straightforward answer. I'm not sure that our policy toward Korea is going to change significantly if you take a middle class lens to some of those problems. But on the security side, we did hear, for example, a couple interesting points. One, you know, defense spending and the defense budgets do actually support a lot of middle class communities. You know, it's not maybe the foreign policy question you just asked me, but like, so on the progressive agenda, right, there's a much more of an interest in cutting defense budgets significantly and really retrenching. We did not hear in a lot of those conversations that we had a lot of interest in that for a couple of reasons. One, the one you just said, which is people want to feel safe, and that, you know, there's a strong expectation that the American security community, the U.S. security community, is going to protect their population from terrorist threats and others. So I don't think people want to see us cutting that back. You know, I think they see it squarely as part of what the U.S. security community should be doing, is protecting them. But they don't want to see big cuts in defense spending because there are lots of communities that depend on that defense spending. So I think that's kind of one broad connection. But they were also, you know, part of the conversation was, well, could we find ways to help some of the communities that are very dependent on defense spending of a particular form, find more diverse sources of support than, you know, strictly on defense. So the report talks a little bit about ways you might think about spending defense dollars a little bit differently. Is there's ways to use the defense budget to build up cyber workforce skills, to do more on advanced manufacturing that kind of connects between defense and the innovation base and some of the things that we need to see in terms of better job creation. So I think people saw some connections between the way that security spending is done and some of the things that the communities where that defense spending happens need. But I agree with you in the sense that, you know, how do you redo a Russia policy with a middle class lens? And so it may not apply to every aspect of U.S. foreign policy.
Well, let's talk a little bit, Roz, about those areas where it would seem to apply. And obviously the one is trade. And as you look at it, I will note that the reaction that many pro-trade economists have to the report is that, from their view, and I think you alluded to it earlier, the report, in their view, sort of endorses a retreat or a withdrawal. It's been called sort of a soft protectionism. And that, while that may be appealing politically, it will, in the long term, be self-defeating, that it will actually undercut the position of the middle class. And economists, I mean, Adam Posen has a piece in Foreign Affairs recently, which talks about efforts to try to preserve manufacturing jobs as engaging in nostalgia. How do you respond to those sort of criticisms?
I think they are misreading the report a little. I mean, if you really look at the report carefully, it takes pains to note many, many places that many of the people we spoke to have a strong faith and belief in the benefits of economic openness, the benefits of trade, the need to engage in the global economy and that there are huge opportunities for communities to engage productively and to succeed. And we did not hear from lots of communities that they wanted to be closed off to trade. That's not what we heard, and it's not really what we reported, you know, in the state level reports or in the final report. But I would say, you know, trade is an inherently redistributive process, right? That is what it does. And to not be willing to engage or to neglect to discuss deeply and thoughtfully what those distributional impacts are and help prepare communities to meet them, I think is one thing that has gotten foreign economic policy community into a little bit of trouble. And I agree with Adam, actually, when he talks about the need to be thinking about adjustment much more broadly than just trade related. I mean, how do you really, you know, why do you pick out trade losses and not be thinking about technical change and other aspects of different kinds of economic shocks that affect people? And that's why, I mean, I do think the administration is looking to do things like expand access to healthcare to make it more portable, trying to enhance and support labor force participation through, you know, some more childcare and more generous benefits in various ways. I wouldn't be surprised to see, you know, some things on labor mobility and economic mobility generally, sort of an understanding that these general policies are probably a better way to go than very, very targeted trade adjustment assistance, which I agree with Adam that I don't really think that that's going to solve the broader problem that American middle-class families face.
Well, I've seen some people write, I think Martin Wolf in the Financial Times has certainly pushed this line of argument that what the United States really needs to do in the face of globalization is not withdraw from the world, but to provide a better social safety net. And that part of the challenge we face is that we don't have the kind of social safety net that you needed so the economy can remain vigorous and innovative. And people get hurt, and because they get hurt, they look for something to blame and they tend to point to trade as being the main culprit. And that leads politicians to not want to endorse trade, which then leads the United States not pursuing trade deals. I'll simply note that most other countries, when the United States says it doesn't want to do trade deals, say fine and go off and do trade deals on their own, which over the long term, I would think is going to come to the disadvantage of American producers, but also American workers.
I mean, I think I would agree with a lot of kind of what you just summarized. I would just say, I think the administration is interested in trade. I think they're just going to try to find those avenues that sort of solve problems initially. So I think that it's probably going to be more of a building blocks approach. You know, let's kind of go after digital services trade and see, you know, what we can build out, solve that problem, tell that story, make it very concrete, make it very tangible. And I think that approach is simply a way of trying to be able to tell the story about why trade and free trade and negotiating with partners and trying to, you know, advance different sectors is going to be a little easier to sell politically. I mean, you know, we live in a political environment, right? You have to kind of be cognizant of the political realities that you face.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But I do think that, I mean, I think Martin Wolf is exactly right. Like, I think you can't put the American, you know, workforce on the front line, you know, of the global economy and then provide very little in terms of, you know, a safety net, you know, like a sense, like if I fall and I might lose my job, right, I'm going to be able to transitioned into something else. And a lot of those mechanisms have just not really been very smooth or very generously funded.
I'm curious, Russ, you know, from your perspective, sort of looking at the administration, which has clearly said that it wants to think about its foreign policy in terms of the impact on the middle class, how does it or should it sort of handle the issue of trade-offs? It is easy to say the administration should sort of think about impact of decisions on the middle class, but obviously when you are president having to make decisions, it isn't always the case that everything you want lines up, that you do have trade-offs. So, for example, you may want to have more help from the Europeans in dealing with the China challenge, whether military, economic, or political. But if you want something from the Europeans, that probably means you can't push the Europeans as hard as you might on something like a digital tax or any other issues that may actually impact people in the American middle class. How do you think about those trade-offs?
Well, I think we're always making trade-offs within foreign policy between, say, some sector's economic interests or a region's economic interests or a party, or, you know, we're always making these trade-offs. So I'm not sure that, you know, any administration is going to get any kind of relief from that problem. So I think, you know, in terms of where the kind of U.S. public is in terms of some of their priorities, one very high one usually ranks very high in public polls is things like preventing shocks and safeguarding the economy. So from the worst types of damage that that are very difficult for households to recover from. So I think that's something that would be hard to trade off, right? I mean, we're not going to make ourselves extremely vulnerable to things like that. And I think with COVID having hit, you know, so hard and so quickly, and then we have sort of cyber intrusions that are also, you know, coming in quickly and clearly, you know, being in a kind of more globally connected world, some of those shocks transmit quickly. So I do think that there's some need to preserve economic stability and kind of prevent shocks. I think that's going to be a very high priority. I don't think that's going to get traded away. This other area that's very high up on people's lists, used to call protect jobs, which is usually very high on people's lists. I think that in that sense, there might, I don't want to say it's a trade-off, but I think it will be reframed. You know, a lot of things that we can do with allies are not necessarily going to sacrifice jobs, but they may simply shift the pace of job creation. They may shift the sectors in which jobs are created. Some of that is, I think, negotiable. They've always been negotiable. So I don't think that's going to really change a whole lot. I think a third one on the list is countering China and Russian power, the ability to really challenge the United States. And it kind of goes back to the sense of security and feeling that the system is stable. And so I think, you know, the fact that the Biden administration is out trying to find ways in which to try to, you know, I think the phrase with Russia was stable and predictable. I don't think that's surprising, given the emphasis on trying to create this sense of, you know, greater security at home and use foreign policy to do that. So I don't see that, you know, I don't necessarily see that as a huge trade-off. And I think the interesting thing is, you know, when you look at how certain economies or certain parts of the country responded to the trade war the Trump administration launched, it was a very nuanced approach, right? Like Nebraska, which has a lot to lose or had a lot to lose, recognized the risks of that strategy. They were concerned about the strategy, even it's a pretty Republican state. But at the same time, they were happy to see the president challenge China and really kind of shake things up a little in terms of how we approached China. So there's a very strong sort of sense of we want people to play by the rules. And, you know, we don't want people, you know, free riding on the system. And, you know, the cost of U.S. leadership shouldn't be so high.
Well, I'll just note on that particular issue of the trade war with China, one of the ways the Trump administration muted criticism who bore the brunt of that was they provided government support. Agricultural support essentially equaled the amount of money we brought in from tariffs so that the U.S. taxpayer, in essence, softened the blow for those people that hurt. And I agree with you that there are many people in red states and rural areas who were very supportive of the president's policy, even though it was hurting them directly for the reasons that you point out. Mm-hmm. But perhaps on that point, we will close the president's inbox for this week. My guest has been Rosalind Engel, a distinguished professor of practice in economics at the U.S. Naval Academy and a non-resident scholar in the Geoeconomics and Strategy Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She is the co-editor of the Carnegie Endowment report, Making U.S. Foreign Policy Work Better for the Middle Class. You can find it at carnegieendowment.org. Ross, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. It was really fun.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you as always, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.